Welcome to The Informed Life. In each episode of this show, we find out how people organize information to get things done. I am your host, Jorge Arango. This is episode 100 of The Informed Life podcast. To celebrate, I decided to dedicate it to you, the show's listeners. So today I don't have a guest. Instead, I will be answering questions sent by listeners of the show. This is the second of these listener QA episodes, and I plan to do more in the future. So if you have questions you'd like me to answer on the show, please send them via email to live@theinformed.life. That's live@theinformed.life. Before we get on to the questions, I have two bits of housekeeping. The first is that we've launched a new website for the podcast. It's still at theinformed.life and still features full transcripts and notes, but the focus of the new site is speed and findability. In particular, the list of episodes now lets you find conversations based not just on date, but also on the name of guests and the topics we discussed. Pages load much faster, and there are also quality of life improvements like dark mode. The new site is based on a different platform, though, so you might see a few bugs. And if you find any, please let us know by sending an email to live@theinformed.life. The second bit of housekeeping is more commercial in nature. I'm teaching a new cohort of my IA Fundamentals workshop at the end of November. Over 4 weeks, I'll guide a small group through a hands-on introduction to the discipline and practice of information architecture. It's a great opportunity for UX and product designers who need to know about structuring websites and apps, but don't expect to specialize on information architecture. If you like the subjects we cover on this show, this workshop will give you the opportunity to dive more deeply. There are only a couple of places still available. So if you're thinking about participating, sign up today by visiting ia.wtf. Okay, enough of that. Now on to listener questions. The first question comes from Vinish Garg. And I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Vinish. I'm going to paraphrase it a little bit for the sake of clarity here. But the question says, when smaller organizations with around 40 to 50 persons have validated their product and market, they see the value of specialized roles in design, including information architecture. How do they move backward from a working product to the foundational IA steps to bring more structure and scalability proofing to something that is already working? Well, if I understand the question correctly, it implies that you've created a system that works, but you're considering circling back to do it right so you can grow it later. I'm going to question the premise of this question. See, there's a lot to be said for effective structures that develop organically over time. And conversely, it can be difficult to plan ahead without trying to address particular needs that come from real-world problems. It's hard to think about these things in the abstract. One of my favorite design principles is Gall's Law, which comes from John Gall's book, Systemantics. And it says, and I'm quoting here from the book, "A complex system that works is invariably found to have evolved from a simple system that worked. A complex system designed from scratch never works and cannot be patched up to make it work. You have to start over with a working simple system." End quote. The idea here is that it's very hard to think about complex structures in advance. You really can only design complex structures when faced with real-world challenges. This actually jibes with my experience in the field. The best systems evolve incrementally over time to meet the needs of the people who use them, and the constraints of the context and content that the system needs to present. And it's difficult to predict those things in advance in theory. One implication of this principle is that the best time to expand the system's information architecture is when you have a real need to do so. So real needs might be that, for example, the organization is expanding its portfolio by releasing a new product. Or maybe the company has acquired a competitive product that comes with its own structures and needs to be integrated into the whole. When integrating a new product, you can think about structural elements that span across multiple products. And this sets you up for future growth. But it does so under real-world conditions and not in theory. It also allows you to measure the results of changes so that you don't go too far in formalizing things that haven't been tested and validated by real-world use. It's worth noting here the difference between the actual semantic structures that are present in the product, that is, its labeling and navigation systems, for example, and the documentation of those things. These are not the same. It's useful to document the information architecture of products in a portfolio. That way, you can have a big picture view of the distinctions and relationships between concepts in the system and avoid either reinventing the wheel or inadvertently using terms in ways that overlap with what other product teams are doing. This documentation can be produced when redesigning to integrate a new product or feature into the system. That said, documentation can become quickly outdated. And usually organizations don't have anybody responsible for updating IA documents in response to changes in the product, which can lead to trouble down the line. An analog here is building plans. Large buildings have sets of drawings that describe their spaces, structures, electrical, heating and air conditioning and plumbing systems and so on. And these drawings save a lot of time and money if you want to remodel or alter the building in any way. But they're only really useful if they're accurately reflecting the physical building, you know, the actual stuff on the ground. As a result, it's important to update the drawings if something changes. Something similar can be said of information architecture. Fast-growing organizations have teams generating lots of semantic distinctions, you know, whenever they create a new product or add a new feature to a product. And most of these things aren't being formally documented in a centralized way that can be used by other teams working on similar challenges within the organization. This can be a source of trouble as the system grows, and it's a missed opportunity for organizations to start, like you're saying, Vinish, to plan for future growth. Next up, we have a question from Nigel Rollins. Nigel, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name. But Nigel asks, one of the problems I have with Tools for Thought using Rome with 11,000 plus pages and feeding it with Instapaper, Matter, and other notes is that it needs some understanding of coding. It annoys me that there is this learning curve. With shiny new ones appearing, what are non-geeks to do? Yeah, I recognize this as well. Many of the new connected thinking tools like Rome Research, Obsidian, etc., and those are the ones I'm most familiar with, require a lot of tinkering. And that's understandable because it's fairly early days for this stuff. Well, that's not really fair because many of the ideas behind these products have been around since at least the 1970s, mostly in research contexts. But over the last couple of years, we've seen new, more mainstream hypertext note-taking tools like Obsidian and Rome attract a new generation of users. And as happens with many tools, you can draw a bell curve that describes who's adopting them and for what reasons. The classic adoption curve has five stages. First come the innovators, folks who are pioneering new ways of being through the new tools and practices. They're oftentimes the people who are making the tools. Then come early adopters, and these are folks who are excited by the potential latent in these new tools or processes or whatever, and are willing to put up with a bit of pain to integrate them into their workflows. This may be because early access costs a lot of money, but it could also be that it requires specialized knowledge. The next wave after the early adopters is the early majority. And this is followed by what is called the late majority. And ultimately come the laggards. And these are folks who only start using the new technology reluctantly because at that point, they basically have no viable choices left. Many of the products in the current Tools for Thinking space are still in the early adopter stage. And as Nigel points out, some, such as Rome, require a bit of tinkering to make them do more than just the basic stuff. I'm personally doing amazing things with Obsidian, but I've had to put a lot of time into learning the system, installing plugins, struggling with sometimes uneven documentation, and so on. Now, I find it appealing to have so much control over the tool, but I'm an early adopter. For the early majority crowd, all of these things, which give us so much power, represent friction. And friction hinders adoption. It's worth noting that it's often early adopters who smooth out the rough points to expand the system's appeal. So I would say, Nigel, even though it might be annoying, it's still early days. And it may be up to folks like you and I, who are adopting these tools early, to smooth the path for others. Next up, we have a question, and I'm sure I'm going to mangle this name. Apologies in advance. This question comes from Diguamage Refilue Diguamage. Sorry, Diguamage, I apologize. The question says, can friction in getting things done be considered a good thing? I say this as I believe that when designing a user journey, for example, a point of friction can serve as a pit stop for a user, in that they are able to reflect and learn on whatever is they had to do to get from A to B. So essentially, a question about friction and whether friction is sometimes desirable. I think this is a great point. I do believe that some things work better when we slow down a bit. For example, studies suggest that taking lecture notes by hand is more conducive to learning than typing them into a computer. And this is at least in part because many people can type faster than they can write longhand. So they tend to transcribe what they hear verbatim when they take notes using computers. By introducing a bit of friction, you know, in this case, the literal friction of pencil against paper and the fact that we are slower when taking notes by hand, you listen and capture differently. Another example that comes to mind is agreeing to terms and conditions when going through the onboarding process for a digital app. There are competing forces at work here. On the one hand, product teams want users to complete the process as quickly and smoothly as possible. But on the other hand, compliance teams want to ensure that users know what they're signing up for. If users rush through the terms and conditions process, they might not understand what they've agreed to. But if you make these legal documents too long, most people would just skip them. So there's a balance to be struck here. Our social and economic environments nudge us to move ever faster onto the next thing. We get impatient if we have to wait in long lines like those we find at security checkpoints in airports. Those are mostly a waste of time, and we should work to reduce the friction of going through security. But we should give some things more time and attention. For example, here in the US, it's not unusual for people to order food from the driver's seat of their cars and sometimes eat it there too. This seems to me like a problem we've over-optimized. Eating isn't something to be dispensed with so we can get on with our day. It's an activity worthy of our attention. Taking the Guamajay's lead, I encourage us to consider that some interactions require more contemplation than others. Intentional friction can serve a purpose, so mindful pauses can be another color in our palette, something that we can use in interaction design to get people to interact more mindfully with the systems that we design. The last question comes from Ruben Stegbauer, and I hope I pronounced that correctly. And Ruben asks, what search-related trend are you most excited about? Again, a really good question. I'm not sure if you'd consider this search per se, but the most interesting development I've seen in this space in the last year or so is how we're interacting with AI-driven image generators like DALL-E and Stable Diffusion. As you may know, in these systems, you enter an English language query and the system uses a language model to build an image, whether it's something that looks like a photograph or an illustration that tries to match the query that you've issued. At first, people entered English prompts to see what came out. But as they started experimenting more, they started writing prompts that more directly address the underlying language models to achieve particular results. And there are a couple of things that interest me about this. One is that the systems try to hide the underlying complexity through these natural language interfaces. But users quickly figured out that they could get better results by reverse engineering the model based on the results of various queries. Then they started issuing more direct commands. So people train the system, but then the system trains them right back. The other interesting idea here is that similar interfaces can be used for more traditional search use cases, such as looking through large text repositories. Today, you must know specific aspects of the text you're looking for when starting a search, whether it's a verbatim text string, the title of the document, the author's name, and so on. But there are already systems in the market that let you search using much vaguer queries, where you're looking for something where you don't quite know how to formulate the request. For example, I've been beta testing a service called Elicit, which uses language models to help you search through academic literature, and the results are pretty good. So I expect that we're going to see more AI-driven search interfaces, and that's really exciting. So that's a wrap for listener questions, for now at least. Like I said, I plan to be doing more of these episodes in the future, so if you have questions you'd like me to answer on the show, please email live@theinformed.life. We're coming up on the podcast's fourth anniversary. When I first started, my goal was to get through the first 20 or so shows to see if I liked it. The number 100 kind of snuck up on me. It frankly hasn't felt like work. The show has been something of a mind saver for me over the last few years. I love talking with people, and the pandemic constrained my ability to meet people in real life. You know, I used to love to go to conferences and so on, but that just hasn't happened over the last few years. So it's been a real privilege for me to host these conversations over the last few years and share them with you. I plan to keep doing this, at least as long as you keep tuning in. And on that note, if you enjoy the show and would like to help, the best thing you can do is tell others about it. The world we live in demands that we all get better at organizing information. We're all called to be information architects to some degree. I hope to help by sharing conversations about how other people do it. And the easiest thing you can do to help is rate or review the show in Apple's podcast directory. Ratings help increase the podcast's visibility. You can find a link in the show's website at theinformed.life. Before signing off, I'd like to thank Sarah Clarkson, who provides editorial support for the show. Sarah's help makes it possible for me to publish regularly on top of my busy work schedule. So thank you, Sarah. And of course, thank you for tuning in. I hope to continue sharing these conversations for as long as you'd like to listen. Here's to the next 100.